Well, then next part of the cancer planet mission, and in the last part, the sister of Satura had appeared, and a girl on now from, well, it's page 36 in the original book, it seems. And he says, I had not seen her until she neared the beach on which Satura and I were sitting. I liked the way the woman walked, a gliding, undulating movement, a movement in which body and arms moved rhythmically in a way by that I had only noticed before with her brother. As I rose to be introduced to Siti, I could see at once the family likeness. There could be little doubt that this was Satura's sister. There was that same different chin formation, those same compelling eyes, that same air of charm and authority. And when we were introduced, she looked me straight in the eyes in a way that few women do. But there was no pert boldness in that look, merely fearlessness and utter frankness. Have to roll down. Siti took a chair opposite the bench on which Satura and I reseated ourselves. Her every movement was a study in gracefulness. She was dressed in a glittering evening gown, as though she had just left a very formal reception. But although the ensemble was exotic in the extreme, there was no hint of the Oriental about it, except that her tiny feet were enhanced by golden sandals. An orange half veil accentuated rather than hid her matchless beauty. I'm very pleased to be able to meet you. Her voice was a scented whisper. The pianissimo of a magnificent melody. I caught my breath as I listened to the incomparable voice. One thing at once became apparent to me. Although she was speaking normally, it was obvious that she was employing the same technique as her brother for communicating with me. I looked closely at her charming petite figure. There, dependent on her flawless throat, was a small, bejeweled brooch. It was seemingly an exotic version of the electronic gadget that her brother used. Her voice came from the heart of the fine small brooch, yet the sound synchronized with her lip movements. This was one of the refinements of the gadget. Never were lip movement out of phase with the sound. Satura had a gold, good-natured twinkle in his eyes. Seeking to prove a theory, I suddenly spoke to him in Spanish. He answered without hesitation. His Spanish was correct, the accent perfect, the grammar excellent. However, there was one significant point. There is a whole range of Spanish accents, depending upon whether the language is spoken in Spain itself, in Argentina, in Colombia, or in Cuba. There is, of course, little difference between the Spanish of Mexico and that of Peru. As I have already mentioned, I am fluent in Spanish, for I have made many business trips to most of the major countries where the language is spoken. So I am aware of the regional differences of language. Of course, one has to stay a long time in any one of the countries to speak the language correctly and idiomatically. I persisted with my experiment, continuing to speak in Spanish, but ringing the changes so that at one time I spoke as though I were a native of Spain, the next of Peru. Satura and Siti reacted to the implicit challenge. Their facial expression changed as I altered my intonation. I would see their puzzlement reflected in their eyes. They looked at each other instantly as though they were listening to strange unknown sounds and were trying to identify them. They seemed to be caught in some mental activity induced by imagined sensory impressions that were causing them some tension and ill feeling. Immediately they switched back into English. Thus I knew that they were not truly polyglot, but were relying on some mechanical device. And the only mechanical device visible was the gadget wore by Satura and the watch by Siti. But they were innocent of wires or batteries or circuits or valves. By this time I had recovered my normal composure, human nature being what it is. Inevitably, I paid more attention to Siti than I did to her brother. Of course, I was never this courteous, and he made his contribution to the conversation. I suppose that I am attracted to the exotics in the female of the species, and Siti an exotism in the highest degree. If I were a professional writer, I might be able to probe in depth my feeling that night when I first met Siti. I might be able to find words that matched the beauty of that Indian night and the greater beauty of that glorious woman. Let the thought pass for the deed, for those feelings indeed men usually keep to themselves and don't go shouting about the rooftops. The man in the street, that mythical ordinary man from Lima to Lhasa, would blush with humiliation at the thought that his most intimate thoughts were being given vocal expression. Siti's self-assurance, her rigid self-discipline, her exotism, that hint of mystery about her, that incomparable beauty, all these kindled within me basic masculine desire. This must have been only too apparent at times, but Siti's air of charm, of being in control of the situation, never deserted her for one moment. I was eventually glad about this, for I discovered that she did not react the way I reacted. Not that she was free of desires, but this was neither the time nor the place to express them, nor was it the right technique to employ. For we humans are peculiar people. We can make love, the summit of human affliction in the midst of the most terrible human suffering, in the depths of human despair. We can copulate, then dash off in an airplane and kill a few hundred women and children with napalm and high explosives, then rush back and start making love all over again. Our surroundings do not mean very much to us when our sexual appetites need quenching. This is all supposed to be the perfectly normal behavior in the human animal. Any healthy man who acted differently would soon find himself on the psychiatrist couch or behind prison bars. But as I found out with Siti, she and her others like her are made differently. Or rather, they are not brainwashed or conditioned to this form of behavior. With them, there is an absolute isolation of the spirit from the carnal body. Love cannot exist where there is hate, despair or suffering. And love in this context includes the physical act of love. But as the evening wore on, my contribution to the conversation became less and less as I thought more and more about the extraordinary situation in which I found myself. That was Dawn, end of chapter 2. Next is chapter 3, headlined The Human Comedy, Painless Death. The following morning, I wanted to be alone in order to think over the extraordinary affair of Saturan, Siti, and Itibiratu. I wanted to make up my mind once and for all whether or not I had been the victim of a gigantic leg pull, although why anybody should want to hoax me, a stranger in India, was beyond my comprehension. Also beyond my immediate compression were the reference made by my two friends to their homeland and to their people. Whether they spoke in these terms, there was no doubt in my own mind that they were thinking in ultra mundane terms. All the realist in me bristled in this thought, that there were no denying it. Both of them spoke in these terms in a completely matter-of-fact way that forced credulity upon me. So I wanted somewhere, some place where I could think over the implications of this ultra-mundane frame of mind and choice of words, somewhere to ponder over the essential differences in their physical as well as mental makeup, somewhere to rationalize the whole sequence of events since I had joined the Bombay Madras Express. The crowds thronging the waterside of the Ganges, the sacred river of India, as it flows majestically through Benares, the sacred capital of religion, was the very place for my cognition, for there is no place where a man can be so lonely as in a waste crowd. So I went down to the water's edge, moving among the young Brahmans, the Acharyam, Charyevs, and the Anavastavs. I don't know how to express it. Well, I picked my way through the Aryans, the sons of God, to the gurus, by the madmen and the lazy saints who make you believe in the power of meditation, although their meditation takes the form of waiting patiently for the inevitable tip. There was also a good deal of political activity going on that morning. Burghers were shouting, "India must have the atom bomb." Other beggars, cancelling out the extortions of their professional brethren, distributed leaflets printed in fractured English announcing that A-bomb manufacturers will be heavy burden. I listened to the pro-atom bomb chanting and wondering what on earth was really happening in India. Here was a country impoverished beyond belief, suffering from constant starvation, living on the dole of better organized communities, yet where beggars were clamoring to have the atom bomb. At last I found a suitable spot almost at the riverbank and gave myself over to thinking about my personal problems rather than those of Mother India. I had scarcely started on my self-examination when I noticed Sataram making his way towards me. How had he known that I was in that crowd? How had he recognized me even? How he had known the exact spot where to find me? All these were beyond my understanding, that I was getting to the state of mind when I did not try to understand the mental process of my new friends, but rather was beginning to accept them and not find a rational explanation for what they said and did. "I thought I would find you here," he said brightly. He was followed by several very old men and women who continued their walk towards the bank of the river, where I later observed them praying. Because of certain primitive elements and castles which cling to Indian society, I was surprised to find my friend amongst these the poorest and most miserable creatures, the untouchables. Mr. Saturan asked me if I would like to join him, and without waiting for my answer, made his way in the direction of the Ramakrishna Monastery. It was a glorious day, full of sunshine, as we walked up the ghat to the chants of Sitaram. Since the early morning, hundreds of pilgrims and those ready to die are joined before the sannyas, the holy man. Soon we were mixing with Bistis, Kimitgars, the water carriers, the Skivis, right bang in the middle of the Mahabhirakshikamana. That word, Mahabhirakshikamana, need a little explanation. I think the best translation is the way to ultimate resignation. In fact, it is the waste dumping ground where people, young and old, men and women who are at death's door are brought to await the end. It is one of the most pitiful places in all the world. It is also one of the busiest. Soon Satura was going about his ministrations. I have been in the midst of natural and man-made calamities and seen doctors and nurses, parsons and other welfare workers going about their duties, but I have never seen anybody, man or woman, professional or amateur, welfare worker, act with such compassion and gentleness as I saw Satura carry out his works of mercy in that vegetable Mahabhishnikamana at Benares. He went straight to a crying child that was huddled over its mother. It was obvious that the mother had just died. The child, she could have been no more than 7 or 8, holded to heaven in misery, the tears cleaving a path through the dirt and muck that befouled her face. Satura found some water, and with the utmost care he washed the child as best he could. I myself was almost moved to tears, but I noticed the nearby chowkidars, the watchmen who worked at this ghoulish place, looked on without showing the slightest trace of emotion. Satura finished his task, spoke comfortingly to the child, found something for her to eat, then came across to me. The pity of it all, he said, indicating the mass of dying humanity. What is happening to India? I asked. This was the question that had haunted me, the question to which I could find no answer. What will become of her? Nothing, replied Satura simply. India will always be India. Violence is not the answer. Self-control is. She must regain her capacity to understand her own nature. It took it that Satura meant that India must learn to control own population. Of course, he was right. Pity is not the answer to India's problem of starvation, nor is the sending of 1,000 ships a day to a country laden with food, if that were possible. The control of the population is the only answer to India's twin problems of poverty and starvation, with the attendant misery that these bring in their wake. It was while we were discussing these problems that I saw Siti once more. At first I did not recognize her, for she was wearing a topi and a silken veil hid her eyes. In any case, I would not have interrupted her. She too was ministering to the needs of the people gathered at the Mahabhishnikamuna. It was the children she was helping. She had charmed two beasties into carrying cans of clean water for her, and this she ladled out sparingly. Now she attended to a small mite that was moaning piteously like a mourning dove. No wonder, for the child was covered with open sores. Siti reached into the sari that she was wearing, an elegant green sari. Carefully she covered the child's sores with the yellow pust. The effect was little short of miraculous. The child, It was a small girl, stopped keening. It even managed a faint smile. The ointment seemed to be as much a panacea as the tablets that Satura had dispensed on the train. Tablets and ointment appear to have the power of speeding the recovery of bodily organs that still functioned, however imperfectly. They brought the blessing of peace to those in need of death. I use the expression "in need of death" advisedly, for there is a point in life when death is more welcome than life itself. I did not trust myself upon Siti, although I longed to talk to her. Instead, I crept away, leaving her to her task of healing and comforting. As I did, some words that Satura had spoken the previous evening tendered through my brain. My people, I long know the real horror of the sin of negligence. He had used an unfamiliar word that I spelt as resit when I wrote up my diary before turning in for the night. But he had explained that resit meant negligence. How right he was, I reflected as I looked around the Mahabhinish Kamana. Negligence and apathy are deadly sins which we encourage because we are frightened to do anything positive. I thought of all those people living a substandard life in India, in parts of Africa, South America and Asia. I thought of the millions of people who lived worthy, blameless lives and then were punished by being afflicted by some terrible terminal disease such as cancer, a disease which, like so many more, bedeviled humanity could be cured if man could put his skill and resources into the necessary research.